In 2011, Kevin Sharp became a federal judge in Middle Tennessee. That's a lifetime appointment, but last year Sharp resigned. He quit in protest of mandatory minimum prison sentences, measures he says contribute to prison overcrowding and violence. I spoke to Sharp about mandatory minimum sentencing and why he felt he could do more off the bench than on it. Well, I'm here with Kevin Sharp. Thank you for joining us. I want to have you explain real quick why we have mandatory minimum sentencing today. What was the idea that made this law?
You know, it goes back to, if you remember when Len Bias, the basketball player, died, there was this rush to kind of show how tough we had this celebrity die, and there was a rush to show how tough we could be on folks who were trafficking in crack cocaine. Now it turns out that that's not what killed Len Bias. It was not crack. It was regular cocaine, I believe. But that's what kind of drove it. And it happens a lot of times. Without the politicians really thinking this thing through, you just kind of rush because something has grabbed the headlines. And so there was a rush to show how tough we could be and stop this problem. And that kind of drove mandatory minimum sentencing for drug cases.
And you were nominated to a Nashville judgeship under President Obama. What led you to resign?
You know, I had been a civil lawyer before I took the bench, mostly doing civil rights work, employment discrimination work, and had a small practice. I had not had a lot of experience on the criminal law side, and federal judges do both civil and criminal. And so what I saw was a couple of things I realized. One, criminal law is not, the law itself is not particularly complicated. It's fairly simple and straightforward. There are certain issues, but there are about four or five issues on the criminal law side. If you get those down, you've got it. So it's not difficult in that sense, but the criminal law side of it is difficult in the sense that you have human beings and you're dealing with their liberty. Unlike the civil case, you know, I make a ruling as a judge. Plaintiff pays, plaintiff doesn't pay, maybe money changes hands, maybe it doesn't, maybe a party files bankruptcy, maybe they work it out outside of anything that I've done. And so it's all about money. But on the criminal side, when I made a decision, you know, conceivably, and more times than not, handcuffs were placed on someone and they were taken away. And so when you're dealing with people's liberty, it becomes very weighty. You really need to take that responsibility extremely seriously. And what I realized was that the system had certain, not always, but had certain elements to it that were incredibly unfair. And in no way, shape, or form did they represent justice. And those things came with mostly mandatory minimums, which I thought for some of the drug crimes were entirely too harsh. So, you know, that was where some of the difficulties that I had and really had a hard time being part of that system.
And something you handled, commonly known as drug and gun cases. Can you explain what that means? What are drug and gun cases?
So, right, we use that term a lot. That was primarily what you saw on the criminal side of the docket. So you did have some white collar cases. And, you know, a lot of that was driven by greed, and it was a small slice. Most of it was what we called drugs and guns, drug and gun cases. And those dealt with, you know, the movement of illegal substances through the district. And when you're moving illegal substances through, there's an element of violence to that. And so there were guns involved. And you know, it was a fairly dangerous business. And that was the bulk of the criminal cases that came through, at least until the opioid epidemic really started showing itself in the Middle District. And then you didn't have the violence that was attached to moving cocaine or crack or heroin. You really had people who, for whatever reason, had become addicted to painkillers. And, you know, more times than not, there was some injury or some chronic pain that they needed relief from, and they were prescribed opioids for it. So that, you know, the gun side kind of moved, but basically that's what the drugs and gun cases were.
And if you were going to change mandatory minimums, doesn't that require legislative action?
It does, because that's what created it. And my problem with it was that not always. It was really that you didn't get to look at the individual, and you didn't get to really assess the situation. How did someone get here? And there are these principles and policies behind sentencing. And you leave that up to the discretion of the judge. But mandatory minimums take that away. And often, not always, sometimes a mandatory minimum sentence, I looked at it and went, you know, if I got to decide, if I had the ability to decide what that person's sentence was, that number would probably be it. But that was just a coincidence. And so more times than not, you would look at it and just think, this sentence is way too harsh for what's happened, because the policy behind sentencing is not just punishment for the crime. There's protection of the public. There are, you get to look at the character and history of someone, and all of these factors that are listed in the code go into determining what is a sentence that is sufficient but not more harsh than necessary to comply with those purposes. Mandatory minimums take that discretion and take that analysis, really, away from the judge and just say, here's what the sentence is going to be for this particular offense. And which is not to say that there's not discretion, because there is. It's just not with the judge anymore. The discretion is now with the prosecutor, because the prosecutor decides how to charge someone. And they do that, depending on how you're charged, really dictates then what your sentence is going to be.
That's what's sort of curious to me is that constitutionally, we are guaranteed not to endure cruel and unusual punishment. These policies are being set. It's almost like there were safeguards there to prevent policymakers from creating sentencing as a, you know, just de facto, this is the sentence for this. Why even have judges at that point if you are required to hand out a sentence no matter what the extenuating circumstances?
Well, and even if you don't get to, so the cruel and unusual punishment threshold is high, but that doesn't mean that for a particular crime that the sentence that has now been determined to be mandatory is not way over the top. And you're right. You've taken the discretion away from the judge. You're just a functionary. You really don't need a judge for that. You know, here's what the sentence is. You've been convicted of crime, or you've pled more times than not. You've pled guilty to crime X. Here's the sentence. You don't need a federal judge then to have you stand up there and say it. I mean, that's how it works. But anyone could do that because the decisions had already been made with the prosecutor. And, you know, the problem with that then becomes, if this is a, not that this is a game, but if we're playing baseball, I want the umpire calling balls and strikes. I don't want the pitcher. I don't want the catcher. I don't want the batter making these calls. That's why you need a neutral third party. The prosecutors have their job in this adversarial system. They have their job. The defense counsel has their job, and the judge has his or her job. And so, you know, to then leave those functions in the hands of someone who has a vested interest in this coming out one way or the other, then leads to unjust results.
So how are you going to be more effective in private practice as opposed to being a judge?
Well, I think, you know, the judge has a role, and you know, the job is to apply the law as it's written, to the extent you can. Now, there's room in there. You have to interpret the law, but you have to apply the law as written. And I can't be in the position of advocating for a change in that law as effectively as I can if I'm off the bench.
Do you worry about your successor's agenda or leanings?
You know, in this case, I don't. There is a process that folks go through to be vetted for that position. I know both of the men who were the lawyers who were nominated. One has already been confirmed, and one's waiting for his confirmation. They're both good lawyers and fair people, and so I don't worry about that at all. Which is not to say it can't happen and is not happening in other districts, but We have a couple of senators who understand the importance of the judiciary, and they understand the role that judges play. And so I have not seen in this state politics come into the selection of judges. So in this case, no, I'm not worried. I'm looking forward to appearing in front of them.
How enmeshed is the for-profit system in all of this?
You mean on the mandatory minimum side?
Right.
Money drives so much of what's happening. It's interesting. I had a case. I don't know if you followed the private probation company cases. There's another one that's been filed, but one of the early ones was filed in Rutherford County, Murfreesboro. Did you follow those at all?
No, I don't think so.
So what was happening was the county, and other counties have done this, had turned over their probation function to a private company to run probation. And they kicked back or sent a portion of the fees they collected, because they didn't get paid by the county. They were paid by the people on probation, or they were paid by the companies who would run programs that would be part of a term of your probation or your supervised release, which would be, you've got to take a drug course. And so some of that money would come back to them. A portion of the money, though, is actually paid by the probationer. And so you've got to pay, X dollars a week to be on probation, which is not the way it works when the government runs the system. And so there became this adverse incentive for the company to keep you on probation as long as possible. The government has an incentive to get you off of probation, make sure that you have fulfilled your sentence and your obligations, and that you are conducting yourself the way the court has ordered you to conduct yourself, or the way the law orders you to conduct yourself, until you can transition back into society. The for-profit system has a different motivation. Their motivation is, we want you to stay in the system because that's how we get paid. And so what ended up happening is that they would violate someone. Sometimes someone might be violated because they have part of your probation is, don't commit another crime. You commit another crime, that's a probation violation, you're getting picked up, and now you've got two problems. One, you violated probation, and two, you've committed another crime. But sometimes what they were violating people for was you had been ordered to pick up trash, and you didn't pick up trash, and so that's a probation violation. Well, the issue was that the sheriff in Rutherford County was charging you to come pick up trash. And so I can't remember what the exact fee was, maybe been $150 or something like that. And so if you didn't have $150, you couldn't go pick up the trash. And so a lot of the folks that were on probation were either on public assistance or didn't have jobs at all. They didn't have the money, and so they were being violated. The probation company would submit a petition to the court, so they're in violation of their parole, and they would be picked up and locked up. Another way that happened was that if you've been ordered to take a drug course, and you would take the drug course, but until you paid the fee for the drug course, you couldn't get your certificate. And so if you didn't have your certificate to prove you had taken the course, even though you'd taken it, it would be a parole violation, and they would have you picked up. So now you really have been – you've been rearrested because you didn't have the money to pay, not because you've really done anything wrong, but because you're poor. And so you would go into court. The judge would come around once a week and, do you want to contest this, or do you want a – and then in which case you're going to need a public defender that can take up to 30 days, or – you can agree, work something out with the probation company, the private probation company, so that you'll extend your probation and we'll let you go. And that's what most people did, because you couldn't afford to sit in jail waiting to be heard on this issue. And so they would just extend it. There was one gentleman whose probation should have been over years ago, but because he kept having these money violations, he was still on probation. And so essentially what they had done is created a debtor's prison. And all because there was a profit motive in keeping people on, not a social motive in getting, you know, prior folks with prior criminal history back into society. And so that is the problem when you've shifted the incentive for doing what we do. That's the problem that you get with privatization.
Well, that makes sense.
Can I go back to part of what happened? We were talking about money. Is the judge, one of the judges in Rutherford County, took the stand in a hearing. And I listened to this process being described, and I said to the judge on the witness stand, does this make sense to you? And he said, well, money makes the world go round. And I thought, oh, my God, no. That is not how the criminal justice system should work. Money cannot make the criminal justice system go round, because that's not what the criminal justice system is designed for. And I found that response shocking to me. Not that it wasn't true. It was true. That was what was so shocking. And not that he said it. I give the judge credit for acknowledging that that's what was going on. But I found that concept shocking.
Well, Counselor, any closing arguments?
I think, you know, what has to happen is that people have to become engaged and care. Even if you're not the person in the system affects all of us. And so we have to care about how it's working, or more importantly, how it's not working, because ultimately we're paying for it. Are the prison systems overpopulated? Do we have too many people locked up for nonviolent crimes? Are we working hard enough to combat the problem of what generates most crime? And from what I saw on the bench and talking to other judges and prosecutors and other people in the system since coming off the bench, what I saw was what drives crime. Two big things. When you take out greed, which was a small portion of it, mostly what I saw driving criminal activity was mental illness and drug addiction. And a lot of times they fed off of each other. People with a mental illness were self-medicating, or people who had addictions were exacerbating their mental health problems or creating mental health problems. And the system is not doing anything to combat those two big elements. And that is everybody's business, because until we can solve those problems, or at least curtail those problems, we're going to have a prison system that's overpopulated, and somebody has to pay for that. And that's the rest of the citizenry. And so that's why we should care. And we should care because, again, this is the United States of America. There is a fundamental sense of justice and fair play that has to be protected. And that's why people ought to care about these issues.
Indeed. Well, Kevin Sharp, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your time.